The Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins is brought to you by two great sponsors, Letote and Squarespace. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Also, the opinions and analysis of our guests belong to our guests. Enjoy the program.
I'm Dee Watkins here with Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. Today I have my co-host Marsha, Associate Professor of History of African American Studies at Georgetown University. We have Robert Broon, who's an award-winning photographer. Stephen Janis, an award-winning investigative journalist whose work has been acclaimed in both print and television. And award-winning writer Tarik Torrey, whose work has been in the City Paper, in The Guardian, amongst other places. A lot of awards on the panel today. So I want to jump right into the episode and just to give our listeners the reality of what it's like being a young black person in Baltimore. So I'll start here and then I'll let the panel jump in. But I just want to say that nobody wants to greet or, you know, be approached by a police officer on the streets. Doesn't matter if you sell drugs or not. I didn't really realize this until, you know, I think I was like 10 years old the first time police officers jumped out and made my friends, everybody on the corner. And none of us sold drugs, but they were looking for somebody and they made everybody lay on the ground. They made everybody lay on the ground. It didn't matter, you know, what you had on or, you know, why were you outside or what was going on. They just made everyone lie on the ground. And just, you know, to put it in context, if you live in the inner city, you know, you can't hang out in the backyard and it's not a lot of parks. So the corner is kind of like your backyard or like the park. It's the place where, you know, where your friends meet and where everyone hangs at. And you just don't really want that type of experience. And ever since that time, I don't remember standing still when police officers came. I know one time I wasn't going to get caught by police because I was like 12 years old and I was wearing like all white, like white jeans on with like a white t-shirt with like my friend's name spray paint. This is like the whitest outfit I ever had. And I'm like, yo, I'm not lying on the ground with this on. Like, I'd rather take my chances with the alleys and all that. And you know, I won that. So I want to go to Marsha and, you know, get your take on the episode and just to add the historical context to it to give our listeners more.
Hi, everyone. Dee, I'm really glad that you started with this whole idea of like where people hang out, because I think that this is one of the things that everyone needs to understand if they care about this issue. What does it mean when communities don't have public spaces for people to just be, right? And one of the things that I like to talk about in class is the uprising in Detroit. And there's a great documentary as part of the Eyes on the Prize series, which I talked about last time I was on Addendum, because it really captures kind of what is at the heart of this hyper-policing culture. It's people having access to the spaces in their own neighborhoods. And one of the men, you know, said the same thing that you said, you know, we didn't have parks, we didn't have recreation centers, we didn't have pools, all of these facilities that after integration were closed down, right? Things that people should have access to in the public were closed or made private to keep black folks out. And so if the corners are all people have as a space to be, what does it mean when anti-loitering, you know, broken windows policing, what does it mean when the spaces that you can be social and be with your friends are also targets? And so I think that in this episode, you know, we have a lot of people who are talking about the ability for people to just be in their communities. And I think that that's one of the ways that this type of policing culture undermines the strength of communities, because it makes people afraid to be out. It makes people afraid to be with their friends. And then it makes people afraid to come forward and talk about the things that they see in their own communities. And so this episode is really about looking at what are the dynamics that put people in these really vulnerable positions? And then the way that the law protects the highly discretionary nature of things like stop and frisk, and the ways that communities, entire communities, can be designated high crime areas, and then they're even more targeted. And so I really, really appreciate your reflections, and I really hope that people understand that what an impact it has when people don't have places where they can just be free.
And Robert Broon, you founded the DC Media Group, and you actually shot some of those earlier protest videos. Actually, you shot the first protest. Talk about your experience.
My experience, I've been covering police brutality in the west side and east side of Baltimore since about 2011. And it's people characterized the situation in Baltimore since I started covering these types of issues there as a boiling. The pot's going to blow, you know, and they need to deal with the issues. And there was Anthony Anderson and several others, Tyrone West. And it got to the point with Freddie Gray where Kevin Moore filmed what happened, and people had it. It blew up. And I'm seeing change. Kevin Davis seems to be wanting to address it. In Sandtown, the Western District Police Station, Sergeant Briscoe, I've seen her out in the streets over the past year.
But can you take us to that first scene of that first protest that you filmed in front of the Western District?
The first scene was tense, extremely tense. It was tense but still controlled. The anger had blown up. So going back to what I was originally saying, where it was that boiling point, it burst. People were not going to be quiet anymore. The numbers of people who came out were just astronomical. It was just unbelievable for a situation like this. I certainly didn't expect it. It was beyond anything I had seen in Baltimore. And a lot of people in Baltimore were saying that at that protest, that they were finally ready to speak out. And it was intense. It was very intense.
Yeah, these shootings, you know, and one thing that people should know is that police brutality and harassment is not a new thing in Baltimore City. There has been other cases, you know, the family of Tyrone West, and, you know, shout out to Tawana, they're organizing every week. They're still doing West Wednesdays, and it's been hundreds of consecutive Wednesdays that they've been out there organizing and just trying to bring about justice. The system has so many holes in it. And we're responsible not just as citizens and reporters, but as people to fight against these things. And the man who does that very well is Stephen Janis.
Hey, well, so one of the historical pieces to this, and I think one of the things we saw with Freddie Gray's case was a culmination of a lot of historical policies that don't really, I think, get the type of discussion that they, I think, require. And one of the things was the Baltimore City had tried an experiment. Well, let's call it an experiment, a policy called zero tolerance, which was unprecedented historically, and I covered it as a reporter. There were 100,000 people arrested every year, 100,000 people in a city of 600,000. So the type of space problems that you were discussing were completely and complicitly part of the police department's policy to not allow it. I mean, people would get, I wrote stories about people who get arrested during a cookout in their backyard. People would get arrested for standing on a corner. I wrote a story about a 7-year-old who got arrested for sitting on a dirt bike. He was just turned 7. His name was Gerard Mungo. So the Baltimore City Police Department had arrested somewhere around the number of 700,000 people, 90% of whom were African American. You know, as a reporter, I learned things that I didn't know about, like expectorate, which means to spit on a sidewalk, they'd be arrested for that. So the culture in the police department was already sort of predisposed, because you have to ask yourself this question. Why were officers out at 8 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday chasing somebody? That was because, and the one thing that zero tolerance created was a necessity for stats, for constant stats. So you constantly had to arrest people because you constantly had to generate stats. This was pretty much the, you know, design of our former governor and former mayor, Martin O'Malley, now presidential candidate. And, you know, the stats and the zero tolerance.
O'Malley ran for president?
Yeah. You missed
that. I know. That was a joke. I make jokes. He had one person show up at the Iowa caucus. Can we really say he ran? Yeah. And that guy was undecided. That guy was lost.
That was
he
a
was
great
looking
joke.
For like a Texas Woo! Steakhouse.
His presidency, his campaign was, he was data driven. That's exactly right. Because the arrests were supposed to generate some sort of progress. And so people could literally not stand in a corner because the police had unbelievable, discretion that's really historic will come out later on as being historically unprecedented. They had people called the jump out boys who would jump out of vans and literally walk people in African American communities into the back of a van and down to Central Booking. And at Central Booking, they had something called a walkthrough because they arrested so many people they couldn't house them in Central Booking. It was supposed to hold 40,000 or process 40,000 arrests. So people were literally being walked in a line and walked out. So you see a culmination of forces here, and that's where the frustration and anger comes from, that this had been going on without any sort of checks and balances for over a decade.
Before we jump to Tarek, I just want to say that I have some experiences with the Jump Out Boys, and they have no sense of humor. So when I get they have no sense of humor at all. Like, these guys have no sense of humor. So one thing I want to say about that is we have these experiences. The people from the community has these experiences, and I'm sure Tariq can speak to that. But when you push back, or when you get a platform to talk about them, everyone runs in the opposite direction. So everybody wants to claim holier than thou when they already know what's going on. So you have experiences being a young black man in West Baltimore, growing up in the inner city, not necessarily being involved in criminal activity. What is your experience like?
You know, I think at least after 6 or 7, you already have an idea of your blackness being some sort of stain against you and your humanity. And I think once you get that taste of interacting with the police, it exposes that double consciousness that W.B. Du Bois talked about, when now I have to have a super hyper vigilance of myself and how everybody that around me is reacting to my blackness. And especially with police, you know, our dictate was always run first, ask questions later. We can talk about why they jumped out later. We can talk about why they pulled up later. We can talk about why they said, hey, come over here later, because we don't want to find out what could possibly happen, because we know the history of everything that has gone on in our communities. I think at an individual level, you feel almost hunted. You feel like you're in the middle of a forest and these are like deer hunters. And you start to lose your own humanity because you start to feel like prey. And I think in the case of what happened with Freddie is that you had the hunters actually execute the prey, but instead of just being in a forest in a serene area where nobody's watching or paying attention, it happened on Front Street for everybody to see. And it's just one instance of, you know, this type of hunting that has gone on, and the type of hunting that people like Martin O'Malley endorsed and still to this day stands on. Interestingly enough, I saw him at the rally at BWI for the immigration ban. And I shook his hand. I grabbed his hand like real, real tight. And I said, you locked up half of my zip code. And he was like, wow. We had the lowest, you know, crime rate. And so I said, yeah, because everybody was gone. Yeah. So that part of data-driven corralling of just black bodies on a personal level, you almost feel, even walking into this building, you're always looking right, left, down the street, making sure you're watching things. You know, like, you have this type of vigilance that I think, you know, other people who aren't of color, specifically, you know, from West to East Baltimore, places like that, they don't have to experience. And it causes a kind of like subtle neurosis in you.
It reminds me of what the comedian Jared Carmichael said in the special the other night. He said, being black is exhausting. Right? He said, we're not always dancing and slam dunking. It's like the other stuff too.
What's your next move? Are you setting new goals? Starting a business? Changing careers? Or launching a creative project? Whatever it is, you know it's time. So make your next move with Squarespace. With Squarespace, you can lock down your next move idea with a unique domain. Squarespace is going to help you create a website to launch your idea, publish your portfolio to get your project out there, open an online store for business, and more. That's because Squarespace gives you a powerful and beautiful online platform from which you can make your next move known to the world. So make your next move. Get your unique domain and create a beautiful website. With Squarespace, you get award-winning designer templates, 24/7 customer service, and a unique domain experience that is fully transparent and simple to set up. Squarespace is used by a wide range of creative people, musicians, designers, artists. Not only that, but business owners use Squarespace as well. Maybe most importantly, it's used by us. That's right, podcasters use Squarespace to get in front of your eyeballs. So maybe podcasting is your next move, huh? Whatever you're gonna do, make your next move with Squarespace.
You know, one of the things that I think is so important about this conversation that we're having is that this idea that one person is the victim of this type of brutality and irresponsibility loses sight of the fact that, you know, victims of violence are loved by people. They're loved by their communities and their families. And I think that there is this, you know, talk about the devaluation of Black lives, that you could imagine that a person says to you, you know, you've locked up half my community. And the response is like, these were good numbers. I mean, that, if anything, demonstrates the disposability of Black life. It's that. It's the fact that people are lost and there's a sense that no one is left to mourn them is the part that I find most heartbreaking when people get into these ridiculous conversations about these moments, that they're unable to imagine that this isn't about one person. This is about an entire community that has to be reminded of the fear that they're living under.
Yeah, I mean, it was actually, it's even worse in the sense that this was monetized. I mean, I did a bunch of stories about people. If you got 3 or 4 arrests on your shift, you could go home early and get 8 additional hours of overtime. So all you had to do was notch a couple arrests, which is why when you say the hunting, that's actually what was going on. And because the people, the officers, and we've seen that recently in the indictment of 7 officers.
Shout out to everybody that ever got away and they had to get back on shift.
Right. We had this recent indictment of 7 officers who were, you know, basically going out and, you know, getting overtime for not even working 4 or 5 hours. Well, back during zero tolerance, people would get overtime for making 3 or 4 arrests. So there literally was the monetization of corralling African-American people in poor communities. And that's been borne out by the Justice Department report and a lot of other things.
So I wrote about one of those officers, Daniel Herschel, like 3 years ago, mm-hmm. and now he's finally being brought to justice. Well, we don't know what's going to happen yet. We'll see.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean,
the wiretaps.
You know, harassing Black people is not that big of a deal. But when you start to like lie about your overtime, then, you know, you could take
a good point.
You could take a Black person and throw him off of a bridge. But once you lie about overtime, something that's sacred as overtime, then you're really going against that. So I want to see how the system treats that. But I also want to know, you know, so a lot of things were uncovered in the episode as far as like loopholes in the stories. I want to open this up to the whole panel. And Mr. Brune, I know you're still with us, but I want to open this up to the whole panel. How do we sit back? Or who polices a system that would allow so many mishaps to happen? It's almost like, you know, these guys are like C students with their reporting. Like, it's so many C minus students. D's in my class, probably in Marcia's class too. There's so many holes in their reporting. How do we let this go by?
We don't let it go by. I don't work for any organization. You know, I work with the media collective that came out of Occupy Wall Street, and we believe in citizen journalism, and that's what it's going to take. You're not getting the truth from the Baltimore Sun or the network TV, and it's going to take communication between people in the community and independent journalism.
But isn't the truth a good enough story? Why do we have to go away from that? You know, both of you guys sitting in the studio, Stephen and Tarek, are both journalists. Isn't the truth a good enough story?
Not really, because, you know, I started writing about this in 2006 and people who were getting shot by police. I mean, you know, like I said, I wrote about a 7-year-old who was arrested, and it was such a crazy story that people, it got picked up by 110 newspapers, but had absolutely no change in Baltimore.
No change.
So no change. I mean, this policy went on for 10 more years, so I don't think so.
I think, when I look at how much they were making, and I think about quality of life and that people are building a certain quality of life off of the backs of Black people. So, you know, 180,000, 160,000, how many kids can you put, your own kids can you put through a private school that you want them to attend? How many kids can you send on trips to go play in a basketball tournament in Florida or something of that nature? So I think even though you have the truth, you can have blatant, they could have walked on Moses Street 9 o'clock in the evening and talked to a kid on the corner and asked, hey, do you know any police officers that are harassing, beating people up and taking their money? They probably could have gave you a whole list, you know, if they felt like it. But we had to do a whole entire investigation into what Black people already knew. And the reason that people are like, yeah, it's because lifestyle is attached to it. So, you know, people are literally, you know, they're creating wealth and they're creating a certain like existence for themselves off of these things. And I don't think that any truth is going to move them unless there's a threat of them losing their liberty. You know, so I think now it's mushroomed out because there's a chance, a small slither of a chance, that they may not see the light of day.
So I remember, I'm old enough to remember when they first installed these cameras all over Baltimore City.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, I remember that. And I remember people freaking out, thinking that, you know, we're going to be spied on all day long. And then I remember the street people saying, yo, you know, we're going to have to do all our business like inside, and we're going to have to maneuver and like change, switch all of these different things around. And I look, you know, years later, and again, nothing has really changed.
No, I mean, the camera, I went into, when they first installed them, to the surveillance room, so to speak. And they, I remember asking one of the people who was running the cameras, and I said, what kind of arrests have you made? And he goes, well, just people drinking beer on the corner.
Oh, yeah, you got to stop that. You know,
I mean, the surveillance cameras haven't worked. The zero tolerance hasn't worked. The amazing thing you talk about is, why hasn't there been any change? But you're talking about the monetization. And you're right. All the wealth accrues to police. 85% of the police officers in Baltimore don't live here. So it's incredible migration of wealth from the city. You know, the war on drugs has made it simple, right? Because crime of proximity. You know, how many cases you've been to where they arrest some person simply for being within 50 feet of a drug stash or something? So it's become this great duplicity between government programs and policing to really monetize kind of constant surveillance in Baltimore.
So on the episode, we have a lot of different stories from a lot of different people who actually witnessed what happened to Freddie Gray, his encounter with Miller and Nero, and basically everything that happened up until he was placed into the van, and with none of these people actually making it to court. Where did the state's attorney's office go wrong, and how were these people excluded from telling their stories?
Well, I was in the trial. You know, it's really difficult. You know, we didn't have much access to what the thinking was of the state's attorney, although I think it would have been helpful to have more witnesses on the stand who were describing. I mean, there was one very interesting thing in the videos that you see, the way the officers were handling Freddie Gray prior to being put into the van. I mean, I've watched tons of arrests in Baltimore. They were handling Freddie Gray like he was broken. And I think what struck me in watching,
they don't normally handle you like you're broken. They normally
have your knee in your back.
Try to, you know.
Yeah, they have your hand in your head. They're, you know, I've seen, you know, they have you handcuffed and prostrate and all sorts of stuff. And I thought, you know, why didn't they have some testimony about, ask those officers, what were you thinking? Why were you so oddly positioned? And, you know, there were a lot of people that we talked to, too, who said that, you know, they really thought he was injured prior to getting the van, which is, I think, what you're talking to, what stems, which is one of the great questions, is why wasn't there any sort of testimony about what happened prior to Freddie Gray getting that van? It's hard to say that he wasn't injured.
Marsha, do you think they folded under pressure, or you think the state's attorney's office just didn't really care about the people in the community?
I mean, I think it's a both and situation. It's very interesting to me that I think that one of the things that often happens in these narratives about, particularly about Black folks and Black communities, is that, oh, you know, Black people stay silent. You know, we were so afraid of retribution. But the reality is that, you know, there are a number of people who were willing and able to share their stories almost immediately, and then the cloak of silence. And so I think that there was probably some, I'm speculating, I think that not enough people were asked and canvassed, but I also think that that is one of the consequences of people constantly living with a broken system, right? So there are people who I think are willing to tell their story, but depending on what other situations they may have, whether it's prior engagement with the police, whether it's legal issues, or whether it's a sense of the futility of the exercise, right? What does it mean for me to share my story if my story is never taken seriously? I think those all wrapped around each other. But I think, as you can, you know, you hear from the episode, people are clear as to what they saw, and people were willing to talk about it. And so I think that that is definitely a question that we'll continue to push on the podcast, is, so what happened to all these people when rubber hit the road and, you know, there needed to be a strong case against the officers? But with that being said, I also acknowledge the fact that all of those people, or twice as many people, could have appeared at the trials and it would also have made no difference. And so I think that's the catch-22 of a broken system being the only place in which these grievances can be worked out.
Because community members, what they say doesn't really matter, but what police officers say actually does, because they're connected to that same broken system. They're an extension of it.
Yeah, I don't think it was, there was any moral, I'd say moral incentive for like large swaths of people to even come forth. Because if you're looking at the history and people who carry this history, Black folks who carry this history, of course, it was a shocking moment and traumatizing moment to witness it. But what incentive provides itself where people are going to say, hey, let's all 100 plus of us go recant what happened? And I don't think that's there. And also on the other side of that, like you said, if the police say the sky is a tangerine color with a little bit of fuchsia, then society is going to buck back and say, you know what, you guys might be right.
But you know, we do have to acknowledge that this situation was different. This got global attention. You know, there's someone out there with their head being smashed in by a police officer right now, and it's not going to make the news, it's not going to make the city paper, it might make Instagram, maybe. So there was some people who were trying to tell their stories, but then, you know, that they just disappeared. Where'd they go?
So, I mean, then we had the question, what attention does then?
Well, Michelle Gross was one of them. Michelle Gross, Brandon were together. Brandon filmed on Michelle Gross's. Michelle Gross lives in the Gilmore Homes area. She was very familiar with Freda Gray, and so is Brandon. So Michelle handed her phone to Brandon and filmed a portion of the Presbury arrest, but walked around the building and also filmed a very short clip of the officers pulling Freddie from the van, jumping on his back. And this is where Michelle, in one of the interviews I did with her, she described Freddie going from screaming to dead silent. Now, I pushed this onto Marilyn Mosby, the Baltimore Sun, over and over and over again. And eventually they got around to interviewing her. And you talk about this cognitive dissonance and people giving up. I watched this with her. Somebody went to her house to interview her and they erased the video off her phone. So it's just heartbreaking to think of what people like this go through, witnessing somebody they know go through this and then have their personal stuff violated. But not only that, it's the news continually with this narrative of Rough Ride. It seemed like Michelle Gross in particular didn't know what to believe, you know, as the weeks went on. Yeah.
Well, I mean, Judge Barry Williams, I sat through parts of the trial, gave a very narrow. I mean, a lot of the stuff we talk about had to do with the judge. The judge gave the prosecution very little leeway in this case. I mean, he really gave a very narrow window on what they can convict in terms of them, you know, sort of ignoring the fact, not putting him in a seatbelt. And because the entire narrative of what went inside the van or Freddie Gray's condition came from the police officers themselves, the prosecution had very little to work with. I mean, obviously, they focused on what happened inside the van because a medical examiner made the determination that Freddie Gray died, you know, his fatal injury occurred inside the van. But of course, the entire speculation has been, and I don't think it was never addressed in court, was what happened before. But, you know, watching Barry Williams operate in that courtroom, I mean, I can only say in defense of the prosecution, he gave them absolutely no leeway. Like it seemed to me just watching it that he was pretty much predisposed to think that this case was faulty from the beginning. So I don't know if they'd introduce stuff or talk to people if it would have done any good with what was going on in that courtroom.
How does Judge Barry Williams look in the mirror knowing these things? I mean, what Judge Barry Williams, for those who don't know, is African American man. Not saying that Freddie Gray could have been his grandson, because I'm sure his grandsons probably don't live in neighborhoods like Sandtown or Winchester. But what if that was his grandson and he was the judge? Would that be the case? And this is a question for the panel.
I think that point is a really important one, D, and that's something that we'll talk about in later episodes. One of the ways that people completely misunderstand these problems and why they're systemic is that they'll say things like, well, some of the officers were black, or this is a black city with a black mayor and a black police chief, as if that makes a difference. I think that we lose sight of the way that white supremacy has agents of all colors, and that these systems need people to buy in at various levels. And when we think about, you know, what does it mean for a black judge to preside over a case like this? You know, yes, his grandson probably doesn't live in that neighborhood. But if we look at, you know, black achievement and black wealth, everyone is one step removed from someone who is struggling in a lot of situations. And so there is a way that that insulation and that distance, regardless of, you know, race, is really powerful. And I think for some of us, it's even more heartbreaking to watch. But I do think that there was a narrative that emerged after, you know, Freddie died about these issues, about, you know, people were more concerned, I think, about the uprising than the fact of what caused it. And I think that people were very, some people were very seduced by this idea of watching this happen under Black Watch, as if it proves anything about the nature of racism in our country.
So I've been harassed by police officers of all colors. Like, it's like the Rainbow Coalition, the Rainbow Coalition of police officers have, you know, and I'm talking non-criminal stuff. And what you say, Marsha, makes a whole lot of sense. And I want to point to Tariq to explain, because a lot of our listeners don't understand how can Freddie Gray happen in a Black city with Black cops, with a Black mayor, with a Black state's attorney, with, you know, Black people just all over the place. Could you explain to how white supremacy works throughout the system? How is this systemic?
So it always confuses me when we look at white supremacy in like a 30-year vacuum or 50-year vacuum. And we want to enjoy the nice, posh parts of what white supremacy and white hegemony has brought to America. So we love the infrastructure and the economic benefits of that, right? But we don't want to acknowledge that 400 plus years of a slave being told to lash another slave, you know, 400 plus years of slaves, you know, being told to breed with multiple other ones against their will, mostly, how that could infuse itself into the psyche of a Black city now, you know, 400 years removed from that, and how you can have an officer who is Black operating within a system. He's nothing but a robot operating in this particular system, built to police people and corral them into a certain area. So we can have a Black mayor, we can have a black president. We can have a black person that makes the street lights, we can have a Black person that draws the white lines on the streets, we can have a Black person to own the stores, all of that. But if the system dictates that, you know, we have to make 4 arrests within this, you know, particular time, or if the system dictates that somebody like a Freddie Gray is a menace to society and that we need him during this period of time in his life to serve this amount of time so we can make money off of it, they're going to do it. It doesn't have anything to do with color in that sense. But you have to understand that people are literally operating on a chessboard. So, you know, if you're on the Black side or the white side, you're still in the game regardless. So people are still, they think, hey, I'm going to join the police force and I'm going to really shake things up and all that. And you realize, like, when they say, look, we need 20 arrests, you're going to lose your job. You know, when they say that you're in center, you can go home after 4 arrests, are you going to not do that? And what's going to be the cost of that? And what happens over 6 years of policing and you're comfortable in that and you've had to go through all of that?
Shopping for clothes can be a hassle. By the time you find something in the store that you actually want, and after all that rummaging around through the racks, it seems like half the time they don't have your size, and the other half, they don't have the color you want. Here's something better to try, Letote.com. Go to Letote.com, that's Letote.com, and try a better way to shop. Letote is a fashion subscription box that sends brand name clothing and accessories right to your door. With Letote, you rent your look and get new clothes confidence every day. With Letote, you get as many totes as you want a month. Simply wear, return, and repeat, with a brand new look for you to try at every tote. So go to letote.com, that's Letote.com, and get started for as low as $39 a month, and enter promo code UA to get 50% off your first month. Fill out your style profile and sign up to get a custom tote delivered right to your front door. Wear what you want, return everything in the mail when you're done, and you'll get a new box within days. Again, that's letote.com, enter the code UA, and feel fabulous with fashion delivered right to your door.
So I think the larger theme for me is there was no incentive for Judge Barry Williams to make the case proceed and have him go back and deliberate. You can clearly see that, you know, there was no incentive for Marilyn Mosby to, what did they say, maliciously prosecute or whatever term that they use, they conjured to say that she was going about trying to prosecute these officers in some type of harmful way. There was no incentive in that. But there was an incentive in initially stopping Freddie Gray for the actual officer who is trying to make quota. There is an incentive from even him going to get processed at Central Bookings. There was an incentive for him possibly going to work in the prison industrial complex where they intended for him to go. There was an incentive, all of that, that harms Black people. And I think that until we start to look at the ways in which that we have incentivized anti-Blackness and the criminality of Black people, then we really can't move forward. And I think systematically, looking at Barry Williams and looking at all the operators who worked in the, on the legal issues of the case, you know, you didn't have too many people say, hey, I'm going to go against the grain and I'm going to get justice for this kid. And even the way that the prosecution put together the case, even who they put in the courtroom first, was kind of a blunder from, you know, the law folks that I talked to, the lawyers that I talked to, you know, that not being the strongest case that they had. Why would he actually go first, knowing that if he walks or there's a mistrial, it's pretty much going to be a domino effect? So there was no incentive in putting that, you know, the strongest case first.
Remember, it's unprecedented for a judge to allow six cases to be tried separately. If there's any other defendants in that courtroom, any other defendants, those cases would have been tried together. And it made it very difficult for the prosecution to prosecute.
You guys are talking about incentive and Judge Williams. Biggest trouble I have with all of this Freddie Gray stuff is State's Attorney Mosby. It's going back on this story at the very beginning. You know, Marilyn Mosby and Nick Mosby conspired to clean up the neighborhood to make Councilman Mosby look good for the mayor's race. So it was this push to clean up North Ave and North and Penn. And it, God, you couldn't do enough episodes on how much Marilyn Mosby screwed up this case. There was one point where, I think it was the last trial, where Judge Williams almost came very, very close to saying, it seems like you're intentionally throwing this trial. It had to do with Judge Williams saying, you don't understand what exculpatory evidence is. But getting back to the beginning, it's when all of this started to unfold, you know, I even confronted Councilman Mosby in the street and said, I've spoken with at least a half a dozen witnesses, and they haven't been questioned by investigators, by your wife. I'm willing to give you their names, their numbers. They want to talk to somebody. And he just looked at me and said, well, there's a hotline that you, a tip line. And these are people, you talk about looking at yourself in the mirror. Nick and Marilyn Mosby live in that neighborhood. I don't know how these two people look at themselves in the mirror.
I want to respond to that. What she did was historic. She basically committed suicide. There's probably a dartboard with her face on it in every precinct in Baltimore City. So I don't know what type of death threats, what type of reactions, or what type of came with her doing that. But what she did was something that has never been done before and that no other prosecutor would have done.
Well, you know, I mean, as someone who's covered police-involved killings, and we mentioned Anthony Anderson and Tyrone West, I mean, the fact that Marilyn Mosby delivered an indictment 2 weeks was something that had never happened in this city as long as I've been covering it. You know, all those other cases that we've talked about, other people who died in police custody, resulted in no prosecution whatsoever. Just the fact that she indicted the officers was historic. What she endured in this city was historic too. I mean, most times when you cover criminal cases, the criminal defendants don't want to say anything about the prosecutor of the case during the case because they're afraid to anger the prosecutor. Well, the exact opposite happened in Baltimore. Constant stream of media from the Baltimore Sun and other people, you know, kind of criticizing her decision to prosecute. And let's remember, let's not forget this very important detail. The warrant that her office issued to obtain text messages from the officers' phones was never served. And the fact that we don't have access to that information, I think could have, because Barry Williams pretty much constructed the case around intent and the fact that they never proved that there was any sort of malicious intent to not seatbelt Freddie Gray in. So the fact that she was denied that evidence by the police department, the fact that the police department was operating, you know, completely independently and not really working with her, you know, I think we had to put her what she did in historic context. If I don't think Greg Bernstein, her predecessor, would have indicted these officers.
I think looking at Mosby, and you know, you can argue, you know, you can, everyone has the right to critique the case and how she handled the case, but I do think with the evidence that has been presented and the police officers basically investigating themselves, it's like we asked her to play a full court game of basketball with like one arm and one leg, you know, against like LeBron James or something like that, a system that stood up that tall. So I understand, like, and I'm, this is at Mr. Brune, I understand your frustrations with the Mosbys and where they may come from. But again, Bernstein would not have charged those officers, not even, wouldn't even have thought about it.
And I think right. that we have to also think about, you know, I actually appreciate everyone's perspectives on this, and I see why this is so complicated, because the person who, again, is supposed to seek justice has other interests, right, that are outside of their very specific job. So if a person runs for office on cleaning up streets, if a person has the fact that they were tough on crime as their bargaining chip for more power and prestige, we see how even attempts to, that seem very, you know, wholehearted attempts to seek justice, how they're compromised by all of these other structural issues. But I do think that there's something to be said about this question of her actions in going after the police officers. Do they fundamentally change the behavior of police officers in the future? I don't think so. And do they inspire other states' attorneys to take this type of action? I'm not sure either. So the larger question is, like, do we see her behavior as just an outlier that was, you know, misinformed and will have no impact? Or is it possibly an opportunity to, again, bring a larger and larger public closer to these series of issues? I'm not entirely sure, but I think it does open up a lot of important questions.
She took a gamble, and she had to choose between the people and the system. She chose the people. She chose the people. And in the end, you know, she lost a lot of support from the system and the people.
Well, I think that's also important to highlight also. Just like we realize that people are multidimensional, I think that that is also another thing that characterizes Black leadership in these positions. Sometimes it can be morally bankrupt and infused by white supremacy. And at other times, it can also, you know, be negotiated in these ways that seem connected but are not fully articulated. So I think that her in this case, and her actions in this case, I think also show the complications of Black folks in positions of power as well.
I think about us being uncomfortable and weirded out by Black people with power. So you have Nick Mosby always being paired with Marilyn Mosby. Naturally, that's because that's her husband. But I mean, for white folks, this is regular. Like, this is a regular thing.
A
you know,
point.
It's like having that that much power. We're about to have, we had Hillary Clinton run for president. So a husband and wife were about to be president, and we were cool with it. Like, you know, we're like, hey, that's awesome. So I think Nick, he's promising what every other politician would promise, is to clean up the streets. He's promising, under the ethos of zero tolerance, he's promising the same thing that any other one of them would be. He's operating from a playbook, a nationwide playbook, and he implemented it in the way that it's supposed to be implemented for the incentives that accompany, you know, that accompany it. So for them to conspire, to say that they're conspiring to make a political maneuver in that way, it's hard to say that, given that Marilyn Mosby actually indicted them. You know, you have that fact that she actually indicted them. Now, how she handled the case is, you know, a whole another thing. But as D said, she committed political suicide doing that. And her, the rest of her legacy is kind of like being dictated off of her actually making that decision.
Let me add one thing to what you just said. So when I said choose between the system and the people, this part of the system is that elite group of Black people in Baltimore, and that elite group of people in Baltimore who already thought Freddie Gray deserved what happened to him before they even knew anything about the case. Yeah. They already, you know, oh, I see these kids on the corner, oh, their pants hang low, oh, you know, one less kid that's gonna do this and that. Like, there's already a group of an elite class in Baltimore and a disconnected class in Baltimore City who are in positions of power who already think that what happened to Freddie Gray was supposed to happen. And so the people who she sided with when she decided, when she said the people have spoken, right? The people who she sided with, you know, a lot of those people aren't voters. A lot of those people aren't part of that elite class that have, you know, economic power in Baltimore City.
Well, I remember with Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, about a year before Freddie Gray, there was an, I don't know, D, if you remember this case, but Officer Cosm, who was caught on video beating the hell out of the suspect. And an officer was holding the suspect while he was getting beaten up, and it became a very big case. It was a year before. And I remember we were asking the mayor about this, and she said, well, you know, she wouldn't criticize. I said, will you fire the officer? Are you going to get rid of this? She wouldn't say that. And then finally she said, you know, law enforcement is not all peaches and cream. It's not all fun and games. You know, there's an ugly side to it. And I think it shows you the exact opposite of what happened with Marilyn Mosby, where Marilyn Mosby really was willing to come out and hold police officers in the city accountable, which is really, as you point out, and it's true, is entirely unprecedented.
So what I'm saying, and I say this to say we're not, you know, we're not here trying to make a super positive case for anybody. We're here just trying to figure out, like, what does it take? What would it take? And this is to you, Mr. Broom. What would it take, or what would a prosecutor have to do to be able to have those officers convicted in this current system where all you can draw from is all the information you can use is solely based on officers investigating themselves?
It would take an honest media. I mean, that for starters, a more open mind, a prosecution team that actually got out into the community and listened to the people. I mean, this was such an opportunity for Baltimore to really make quick, effective change. I mean, if her team, if she got out into the Sandtown area and spoke to more people, the shape of this would have been completely different, I believe.
Okay, so let's double back to our conversation about Barry Williams.
Right.
And what you were talking about, you know, and I was saying, I was trying to figure out or get an understanding of how was it, or how could he have made it so easy to ignore everything that happened before Freddie Gray was actually placed into the van? Well, when the story in the community and in a lot of different pieces of media clearly stated that he was beaten or he was harassed or he was handled in a really, really harsh way before he actually made it into the van.
Well, a couple of things. I mean, we've talked about before. Look at what Marilyn Mosby was experiencing as she prosecuted this case. Not only local law enforcement, the local fraternal order of police, you know, coming out and calling her all sorts of names, but the entire law enforcement establishment in this country was aligned against her. They were leaking information about her family, about her relatives who had worked in law enforcement. So, you know, I don't know what was going on in his mind, but certainly if he had said, you know, if he had seemed to be somewhat favorable to the prosecution, he might have risked that. But also you got to realize the law works really well at sort of enforcing what we've all been talking about. If you look at any of the reports from things like Zero Tolerance, or you look at the Just Smart report, I mean, the absolute focus on African-Americans and poor African-Americans has been abetted by the law. You know, when I would debate with police officers why they chased Freddie Gray because they had no probable cause, you know, there's a Supreme Court decision that says if you're in a high crime area, you know, you can chase them. So really, I think Judge Williams could focus the case on the law, but where he had discretion, and where I think it's important to make the distinction, was just a couple weeks later, there was a case of another officer who shot a man who had his hands up. And Judge Wanda Heard, another judge, had allowed the jury to deliberate for a couple of days when they came back and said they had a mistrial. They couldn't come to a verdict, and they eventually convicted the officer. Now, given in the case of William Porter, the first trial, I think the jury only deliberated for about 24 hours before Judge Williams declared a mistrial. And later on, it came out after some of the jurors talked to the media that they were only one or two votes away from convicting Porter of misconduct. So you can only imagine what would have happened had this jury convicted Porter in the first case and how it would have been different with the 6-5 subsequent cases. So I think it was very evident that he was using the law to narrow focus the case to the point where it was very difficult for the prosecution to wander beyond that because he had set sort of a guideline, and that's where the law can be useful to these kind of policies.
Well, continue with the Porter deliberation and the problem with that.
Well, I mean, basically, you know, a judge has a tremendous amount of discretion. I mean, a judge could tell a jury to stay there for a week and deliberate. And if you're only one or two away, usually, from my experience watching these cases over time, I watched in the trial of our former mayor, Sheila Dixon, for, you know, misappropriating gift cards. They kept the jury deliberating, and a couple days later, they delivered something, a verdict of one sort or another. And I think in Porter's case, had he allowed the jury to deliberate, given that it was so close on misconduct, it's quite possible, it's potentially possible, that they could have returned a verdict of guilty on the Porter trial, which would have been much different. And since he framed it completely in intent, if they'd had the text messages of those officers, it would have been a much different story of intent because we'd have known what they were saying to each other.
Exactly. Marcia?
All of it makes me sick to my stomach because it's all a matter of if this happened, then this, and then this. But I do wonder if all of those things that, you know, you say are true, if we still would have gotten the same outcome, because it is so difficult to hold police officers accountable in this way. And so I think that there are a lot of gaps among a lot of the players in the situation. But I do think at the end of the day, if we continue to live in a culture that devalues Black lives, all of the evidence, all of the video evidence, the DNA, you know, the coroner's reports, all of those things, you know, we can litigate all we want in facts and evidence, but I think that the racism is so deep that it doesn't make a difference. And that's what's so heartbreaking about it.
Yeah, yeah, Marcia, you touched on something that it still sort of haunts me and it really bothers me. It was part of the trial where there was a report one of the detectives put pressure on the medical examiners. Now, I don't know what came of that, but it's, you talk about this deep-rooted problem with racism within this system. You know, it's, I don't know if anybody else heard how they dealt with that detective, but I certainly didn't. You know, it's, you can't expect something to change unless the gears in the system are fixed.
Would you like to respond to that, Marcia?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. I think that the issue at hand is that, you know, when I talk about a system being racist and the actors kind of playing in this way, I think that for a larger audience, like the people who will tweet something to me because I said this, they will say, well, you know, you don't know who a person is in their heart, or it's these like bizarre arguments that if a person doesn't burn down a Black church, then how could you call them racist? And it's the way that preservation and who is valuable is so clear within these systems that people who on, you know, 6 days out of the week might be the most ethical moral person, on that seventh day when they're asked to compromise the situation, or they say, well, you know how it is in those places and you know how these people are and you know I need a little help, that they're willing to bend, you know, every moral fiber to preserve it. That is the type of thing that is so hard to help people understand how that operates. And so I think that, you know, when we look at a lot of these cases, I think a lot about the sexual assault case involving Officer Daniel Hautsclaw in Oklahoma City and how much pain he had caused so many Black women sexually assaulting them, and like what it took to prosecute him, the heavy lift and the solidarity and the support and, you know, the victims coming forward, like all of those mechanisms that were necessary to get justice in this one case. And the problem with that is, all of those resources, all of that attention, all of the time, that's the exception and never the rule. And so sometimes it can feel really overwhelming discussing these issues because, again, we can go over what people failed to do. But I think that if we don't think about how deep the fissure is in the system, then we'll always, you know, kind of feel our, like we're going in circles.
Well, the statistics bear you out because if you look at zero tolerance, for example, 90% of the people arrested were African-American, even though the population of the city is about 64% African-American. Similarly, in the Justice Department report, the neighborhoods that were targeted with the unconstitutional policing were majority or predominantly African-American. And even in things when I was doing research on the city's marijuana arrest rate in Baltimore City, year over year, it was 92-93% African-Americans were arrested for marijuana in a city where it constitutes 62 or 63% of the population. So consistently, statistically, all of these policies are targeted racially. No other way to put it. And that's exactly the way that why this system, I think, and why we saw the narrative emerge from the trial that we did.
And one of the things that frustrates me is that all of these things, you can find them, you know, it's easy to find these stats. You don't even have to do the research yourself. They're compiled in tons of articles.
Yes.
And even in books like The Long Shadow, like you can see the research and it's right in front of your face, yet we still have the same results. What do we do moving forward? We get caught up in our ability to identify the solutions. Like, we're all experts of like the stats and what happens to innocent people every day. So let's talk about some things we can do to change that.
I'd like to start with engagement, community engagement. Baltimore in particular, there's the Solidarity Center, there's Be More Block. I've participated with these groups and shown up to court and testified in court, for example, with Larry Lomax. And he was brought up on just preposterous charges, inciting a riot, assault on an officer. And it's all of these people who I showed up to court with Be More Block and these other groups, these people were let go. I can't think of anybody who got convicted. So when the community steps forward, you know, there's film the police, you know, and respectfully film the police. And it's that engagement. Baltimore, again, is there's a nickname, Smaltimore. It needs to identify itself and other communities around the country with a better sense of community, I think, to be looking out for each other.
Yeah, well, I mean, from my perspective as a reporter, I think we immediately had to sort of deconstruct sort of the structural things that allow this to perpetuate itself, which would be first, the drug laws, the war on drugs, has been pretty much a conduit for all of this. I mean, law enforcement has become in this town a narrative, you know, of how to sort of create a monolithic perception of race. It's the way it's constructed every day. And the easiest way to do that are the drug laws, because the drug laws give tremendous flexibility to police to incarcerate people. Without them, I think it'd be much more difficult for the police in this city to incentivize the kind of policing that is causing problems that are directly related to what afflicted Freddie Gray and what made the Freddie Gray situation possible. So from a very pragmatic perspective, if you dismantle that, you're going to dismantle the constant narrative we see every night of creating this monolithic perception. And I think really fundamentally, it's very basic. I mean, you've seen in the state that we decriminalize marijuana, and I think it's already had an effect. I believe if we decriminalize all drugs, if we really want to eradicate this kind of policing and we really want to see the end of it, take away that power. I mean, if you look at the recent indictment of seven officers in Baltimore who were robbing people and officers and stuff, it was the drug laws that allowed them to get away with most of it, the asset forfeit seizure, the ability to just arrest people. So I think that would be a good step.
I would say that we have to continue revising our commitment and renewing what we believe in. I think that even for folks like us who know the statistics and read the stories all the time, we always have more work to do in terms of growing in our capacity to understand the complexity of the problem and then talking to people. I also think it's always important to revise our narratives of who are the victims and who are the targets. One organization that I adore is the African American Policy Forum that has led the way in the Say Her Name campaign to amplify all the women and girls of color who are also victims of police violence, including sexual violence. And so I think that, you know, again, like, we can't get stuck in a place if we really want to see movement on an issue. And I also think that understanding that there's so many ways to be a citizen, I think sometimes we get stuck on this voting issue, but we know that a lot of people are disenfranchised either by age, whether it's their, you know, criminal justice history, whether it's their citizenship status. And so I think the more and more we encourage people to be a citizen by, you know, keeping an eye on what's happening and policing in the community, be a citizen, don't call the police on young people immediately because that's what you're told is the only way to, you know, encounter people, you know, everything that we can do to revise ourselves as citizens, I think we can make a difference.
And I would say we all have to acknowledge that our system isn't perfect. You know, there's so many people who swear by the system and they look at you as if you're committing blasphemy when you challenge it. And I would just say to those people that if you really, really, really love your country and you think it's as great as you say it is, then you would challenge it.
Well, you make a great point because right now we're having this big debate in Baltimore about education. And the education, our school system has a $129 million deficit. Meanwhile, the police department just ran up $40 million over in overtime, or $30 million. And, you know, you're seeing what you're talking about. Like, how do you change this when you have a police department taking $500 million every year out of the budget and a school system that's chronically underfunded, shifting that funding priority by standing up for your community and saying, you know what, we're not going to tolerate funding police at twice the rate of education, nor are we going to tolerate police spending $40 million on overtime when our kids don't have books. That is a very grassroots kind of way that you can approach this by saying, we're not going to tolerate.
And they look at you like you're crazy when you talk about their overtime as if they're entitled to it.
Oh,
you're not going to take my overtime. Well, you know what the job pays.
Yeah.
You know what it pays. Like, overtime's a luxury. It's not a requirement. You don't just get overtime.
And I mean,
you mentioned overtime. they'll pull their guns out. Like,
you can't. Well, the first time I did an investigation of overtime in this city, and you know, we published all the officer salaries, they would call me and tell me, don't ever call us when something happens to you, and they threaten you. Yeah, they are threatened because it's a huge amount of money. It's huge money.
So can we just go back and just extend? Let's be some simple rules that we need to put on the table. And I don't, simple rules. One, just because you sign up to be a cop, you're not a hero. It doesn't mean you're an instant. It's not just add water and stir. You're not a hero because you decide to be a cop. So let's X that. Number two, overtime is a luxury. You don't deserve to get overtime just because, you know, you took the job. Like, overtime is something that you, it's like a reward, something special.
Well, you have to work the hours.
If, yeah, if it's worth it. And then look at the job you're doing with that overtime. Are you using that overtime to make Baltimore City a better place? Or are you using that overtime to be even a bigger asshole? Like, what are you doing with
it? Well, you know, the officers in the indictment, what did they say? Oh, it's so easy to make overtime in Baltimore.
That's my short list. Feel free, guys, to add to the list. So we're going to start this list. Rule number one, being a cop doesn't make you a hero. Cops and heroes are two different things. Are some cops heroes? Maybe. I haven't met them. I only see them on TV. But number one, being a cop doesn't make you a hero. Number two, just because you sign up to be a police officer, it doesn't mean you're entitled to overtime. Overtime's a luxury. Overtime is something that you get when your fellow cop is like sick from, like, you know, doing whatever they do. What do you guys want to add to the list?
Well, I would say, you know, live in the community you serve and serve the community first, not policing first, which is what are the biggest problems. You know, don't live out in Pennsylvania. We have many cops who live in Pennsylvania.
Bring that money. Bring that overtime money to the city. We can exactly. Use it. Our schools need the money.
Yeah.
Robert, Marsha, the list. Come on, we're going to get this list together.
I'm like, oh gosh.
We got to get this list together. We got to get this list together.
And I would say one more thing. If you're going to say that there's just a few bad apples, when officers are doing things that are wrong, you know, speak up. Be a whistleblower for your community. Don't just say we're all good and there's just a few bad guys. When the people, like in the recent indictment, shows that cops, pretty much these guys operated without anyone saying a word. It wasn't anyone within the department that, you know, exposed their crimes. It was the feds. So be a true whistleblower and take policing's integrity seriously.
I think also the apples analogy I was thinking, because a few bad apples can actually ruin an orchard. The fact that someone doing bad is insular or it doesn't have impact on other people, I think is one of the worst ways of thinking about this problem.
Something that I would like to add is I've worked with Global Revolution Live. Now, a lot of our followers, I would say the most of our followers, are not fans of the police at all. One of the hashtags is ACAB, all cops are bastards. I took a gamble, and I've been in communication with Kevin Davis since the start when he took over from Bats. And the thing was Baltimore police just never really had a good grasp on how to handle protesters. And I've covered protests for many years, so I figured I'll give him advice on how to handle protesters. I also put pressure on him about the Freddie Gray stuff and other stuff, and he seems like he wants to change stuff. But my suggestion is for your listeners to look up Kevin Davis on Twitter and, you know, tweet at Kevin Davis. You know, if this guy really wants to change Baltimore for the better, it's going to take the community to put more pressure on the leaders of the community, on Kevin Davis specifically.
I'll just say, don't forget to say her name. Women and girls are also victims of police violence.
One of the things that I'm still in touch with people in the community at Gilmer Homes and in Baltimore. And honestly, when I told people about this podcast, they weren't too thrilled about it. Not everybody was. People want to move beyond it. But I think it's extremely important to keep this conversation going. You look at seven cops who were indicted, and I think that's a big part because this conversation keeps on going. And it's important to push for the change, to encourage the change, to be a part of that change, to participate. And listen, I'm not a black person, but living in Maryland for 11 years, you know, between D.C. and Baltimore, I know a big thing about black culture is keeping stories alive. That's how the culture stays strong and moves forward. And keeping this Freddie Gray story alive is crucial to Baltimore. And I really appreciate the work that you guys are doing.
Thank you. I'm D. Watkins. You can follow me at D. Watkins World. Today we had Tarik Torre. He's at Tarik Torre. Can you guys let everyone know how to find you and follow you on social media?
Yeah, I'm Stephen Janis. I'm a reporter at The Real News Network. And you can just email me at StephenJanis@TheRealNews.com. That's StephenJanis@TheRealNews. So that's where I am.
I'm Marcia Chatelain. I am on Twitter at Dr. M. C-H-A-T-E-L-A-I-N.
Robert Brun. I'm with Global Rev Live at Global Rev Live. Also, Rousseau_IST.
Okay, great. And fans can discuss the episodes with the Undisclosed or the Freddie Gray hashtag. Tag questions for future addendums with hashtag UD Addendum. Follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram under the handle Undisclosed POD. Audio production by Hannah McCartney and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media. Patrick Coates composed the new addendum music. And Mattel Talent is our producer. Thank you.
The Undisclosed Addendum featuring D. Watkins was recorded at the Moose House Recording Studio in Baltimore. Thanks as always to Ernesto and Ryan at Moose House for helping us to make great audio at their Baltimore studio. Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media produced the addendum, along with super producer Methil Telhan. We want to thank our sponsors for this week's episode, Le Tote and Squarespace. Obviously, Squarespace is great and I use it, but I can't admit to using Le Tote. I could say it all day though. Le Tote. Le Tote. Patrick Cortez composed the Undisclosed Addendum's theme music, and the embed track is Timeless by FMG Dez, a Baltimore artist who has lent his sound to our show. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed's executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Monday for Undisclosed: The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 4. Until then.